The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died at the age of 87.
Anybody who thinks that the China-U.S. tensions are going away are simply wrong.
Is there a real threat right now to the U.S. dollar's status as the world's reserve currency?
Yes, there is a threat. It's an evolutionary type of process.
Snowflake certainly made history in many ways yesterday. It's the biggest software IPO ever, the biggest IPO of the year, and the biggest first-day jump for an IPO that raised more than $1 billion, in about two decades.
Coronavirus cases are on the rise in Europe. The WHO is calling this new wave of European cases a, quote, wake-up call.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Correction in technology shares continues to impact the market averages, with the S&P 500 chalking up its third week of consecutive declines as both the NASDAQ and the tech-laden S&P 500 broke through their 50-day averages this week. The big tech companies with stretch valuations continued their sell-off, which is impacting the major averages, including the Dow Industrials. Another influence on the markets were comments made by the Fed. The economic outlook remains uncertain without more stimulus. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour will be Bloomberg's Gina Martin Adams. Gina thinks the market is going through a healthy correction and a rotation out of technology, which is healthy. She discusses what sectors the money is flowing into and why you want to stay the course in equities. Next up, Mark Chandler from Bannockburn joins me. Mark thinks the dollar supercycle is over, which he believes will be a positive for U.S. manufacturers and, of course, commodities. Later on in the program, Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will be here to discuss smart macro events influencing the markets. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. You know, hard to put a thumbprint on three catalysts this week that moved the market, but there were plenty of interesting developments to talk about. For starters, Merger Monday made a comeback this week with the announcement from NVIDIA. It plans to acquire Arm Holdings for $40 billion. Gilead Sciences buying Immunomedics for $21 billion. And Verizon buying TracFone for $6.25 billion. With the addition of Apple's product release event on Tuesday and Monday's merger news, growth and momentum stocks got the reprieve they needed from 2 weeks of losses. The NASDAQ was able to rally 3.7% from Friday's low before giving up those gains after the Fed meeting. The Federal Open Market Committee meeting took place and announced their policy decision Wednesday to leave rates unchanged, no surprise, and it will stay that way until the economy hits full employment and an average 2% inflation rate. It was noteworthy there were two dissents on the new inflation guidance. Powell did a good job communicating that the Fed is being flexible and also that the inflation rate will likely run hot over their 2% average target before they take any action, but that could take some time as they see slack in the economy and employment for a while. Their projections for the economy show improvement in real GDP this year, while expectations are for 2021 and 2022 were tempered lower than the previous projections. The dot plot for interest rates shows plans to keep things unchanged all throughout 2023. So extending things there, I think, a year from the last projections. There was an initial pop in the market on the decision to leave rates low for this long, but most of these developments have been well communicated before, including the average interest rate back at the Jackson Hole conference in August. So not a whole lot of movement in the market after the fact, and we saw the market reverse after the meeting. Let's talk about Snowflake, the biggest software IPO in history, raising $3.36 billion on its first day of trading. The stock was priced, its IPO price, at $120 a share, but actually opened up at $245 due to demand and the small float that was being offered, which was only, I think, 28 million shares. Snowflake is a cloud platform company that's built into Amazon, Microsoft, and Google Cloud, and it allows enterprises to consolidate a large amount of data into a single source that takes the data and then creates analytics to give its businesses key performance indicators, something we call KPIs. What has made the company IPO so well demanded has been its growth of revenues, up 132% in the first 6 months of the year, as well as, I guess, a stamp of approval from Berkshire Hathaway and Salesforce, each both investing a total of, I think, $250 million through a private placement in the company. In addition, Buffett has agreed to buy another 4 million shares from the former Snow CEO Robert Muglia at the IPO price of $120. So again, kind of a stamp of approval at those valuation metrics. Currently, the company is operating at a loss of $174.1 million for the first 6 months before the IPO. It's an IPO that's not without its risks. The economic news this week was mostly good, lending buyers of cyclical stocks plenty to think about. Industrial production was up 0.4% in August, but slowed from July. We started to get some insight on manufacturing this month from the Empire State Manufacturing Survey, which was better than expected, up to 17 versus 3.7 in August, while the Philadelphia Fed cooled down a little bit, decreased to 15. So some mixed news there for September's manufacturing numbers. The NAHB's housing market index hit a new all-time high of 83 in September. Housing starts were down month over month by 5%, but single-family units inside the index were actually up wonderfully, up 4.1%. Consumer sentiment for August went up, but the main point from the report is the view that things can't get worse than they were back during the shutdown. So there's still room for plenty of improvement there. I still think it's down below where it was a year ago. The leading economic index increased 1.2% in August, which is the fourth straight month of improvement. So again, plenty of news there for a lot of buyers in cyclicals to think about. And finally, let's talk about the tech and growth stock correction resuming towards the end of the week to help the NASDAQ close down on a third week of losses. Selling off after the Fed meeting Wednesday, I think, communicated while the Fed is being supportive to an economic recovery, it's not the bullish catalyst to speculate in stocks like it once was coming off the March lows. Some viewed the strength in the Snow IPO as a sign of the times and a contrarian signal of irrational valuations. The tech stocks are now dragging the S&P 500 below its 50-day moving average and I think briefly hit below 3,300, which was another psychological support level on Friday where it closed just above that at 3,319, but again below that 50-day moving average, a key metric that a lot of technicians follow. The continued weakness in tech was helped by the Department of Commerce saying it is going to block downloads of TikTok and WeChat apps on September 20th, that's this Sunday, as well as services for transferring funds and payments within the U.S. using WeChat. Like the fears we had last week over the White House considering restrictions on China's largest semiconductor manufacturing company, the clampdown on TikTok and WeChat is fostering fear of retaliation in the tech space. Quadruple witching stock expiration was also to blame for the volatility on Friday, but probably added to existing pressure that seemed to resume again, like I said, after that Fed meeting on Wednesday. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Jim, back to you.
If you're just looking at history, there are some data points that are not too positive for Trump. In particular, incumbents are 0 for the last 6 when there's either been a recession or a bear market. We define a bear market as a 20% drop in the Dow in an election year. And I think applying this to 2020, the real question is, do people blame Trump? Do they say COVID came out of the blue and now he's the best person going forward to help the economy recover?
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, the markets are back in correction mode, going virtually nowhere over the last couple of weeks. What does this mean? Joining us on the program from Bloomberg is Gina Martin Adams. Gina, I want to talk about the markets are kind of dissecting the Fed's meeting this week, where Chairman Powell basically came out and sort of gave a dire outlook for the economy going forward, especially the small businesses that could be vulnerable as a result of these shutdowns. So why don't we begin with the economy and what this might mean for the market going forward?
Yeah. First, thank you for having me. Obviously, it's a critical time in the equity market and always fun to chat with you about it. But so here's the way that I see things. I think the Fed is, like most of the rest of the portfolio managers in the world, a little concerned about the outlook for the economy, but the market is telling you something else. And if you go back to the beginning of September, when we started to see the market melt down, what you find is that the vast majority of the market correction has been very technology specific. You've got groups in the index like industrials and materials, where stock prices are still rising. You've got greater participation in the energy and financial spaces. These are highly cyclical components of the equity market, which are producing pretty reasonable returns so far in September, continuing on what was a pretty decent August for many of these groups. That tells you that the cyclical recovery is probably intact into 2021, and estimate revisions are supporting that notion as well. So I think what the equity market is actually saying is a little bit different than what the Fed is saying right now. Most of us are worried about the economy, but the equity market is saying the economy is going to continue to slowly improve going into 2021. Certainly, there's a lot of nervousness, and we're going through a little bit of a blow-off top and some exuberant tech names, some of the names that went most parabolic, but the market underlying that sort of adjustment in technology is doing just fine. So not that I want to dismiss the Fed necessarily. I think that it's right to keep an eye on the ball of the economy, but the market is saying something very different than what the Fed is saying.
Yeah, I'm looking just over the last 5 days. You've got basic materials, energy, and you have the industrials. And if you look at within the Dow, you have companies like 3M, Caterpillar, that are seem to be breaking out, telling us a different story.
Yeah, I mean, just take a look at a chart of FedEx. That's a really good example of the transports have been breaking higher all summer long. They broke higher very strongly in August and into September. This is a classic early cycle kind of play. So as long as you've got transports leading, if you've got continued construction gains, you've got materials starting to perform reasonably well, consumer discretionary outside of Amazon doing reasonably well, those are early cyclical stocks. They're stocks that tend to relatively strongly correlate with improvement in economic performance sometime in the next 6, 12, 18 months. So as long as that's continuing, I'm not going to be tremendously worried about, a massive deceleration in economic growth sort of decoupling from or taking out the market at large.
One of the things you mentioned, consumer spending, and one of the analysts brought up the fact that with COVID, with people being kind of locked down for a while, that savings have gone up. So there's a lot of pent-up demand that exists with households, with savings that have been, if you're not going out to dinner, you're not going out to the movies, you're not going out on weekends, money's building up. So there's a potential there to move this economy forward.
There is. And the question is, so where's the demand pent up and how will they spend it? How will they, lay out that cash going forward? I think this is one of the critical issues to consider for 2021 is a lot of that's going to depend upon how we reopen and how we respond to future breakouts of infections, how fast we get a vaccine, how responsive the public is to adopting that vaccine. All of these are critical questions as to where consumers spend. If you take a step back and you think about where we were a year ago, consumers were increasingly spending on services and experiences and not on goods. And this is a little bit of a problem in an environment where services and experiences are limited as a natural result of the unique aspects of this this virus breakout. So where we probably need to see some recovery emerge is really in just economic activity in terms of services. Travel picking up a little bit more would certainly be very, very healthy. I'm sure there's plenty of pent-up demand for goods that has developed as well, but I'm keeping a really close eye on services because we were already in a transition in the economy where consumers were spending more on that. That's where they've had to pull back considerably, outside of course, services that they can enjoy right inside their homes.
You know, the amazing thing about spending, car sales are up, RV sales, I mean, the RV lots, are, they get them in, they go right out the door. People, the boat dealers are selling boats, real estate, they're selling homes. So a lot of these big ticket items has surprised me that a lot of money is going into big ticket items.
Yeah, and that's completely normal at this stage in the cycle. Those are the items that always respond to lower interest rates. So you almost in every recession going all the way back into the 1960s, what you find is when interest rates fall, consumers in the United States respond, and they respond by purchasing big ticket items that are funded by that low cost of capital, low cost of debt. So it's completely natural and very normal for us to see housing pick up, for auto sales to pick up, for demand to pick up for all of these goods-oriented categories, the major outlays that are somewhat debt-funded. And I'd say it's healthy and a sign of economic progress. The sticking point, as I mentioned before, is going to be where do we go from here? We can that'll continue to take us probably into the end of the year and into 2021. But going on forward into 2021, we will need to see that spending broaden to the other left behind categories that, you know, are somewhat dependent upon economies returning to the pre-COVID type of environment.
You know, there's been a lot of attention on tech, obviously the NASDAQ, some of these trillion-dollar companies like Apple has garnered a lot of attention. And I read if you back out the big five tech stocks out of the S&P doesn't look as good as it does if you just look at the S&P numbers outright. But what I'm seeing on the sector performance breakout, it looks to me, and I'd like to get your take on this, that money is rotating. So money's coming out of tech and it's going into other sectors of the economy like industrials, materials, and things that would do well if the economy continues to expand.
I think that's exactly what's happening. That's what's been happening for part of August and certainly so far in September. We have seen rotation really take over the market narrative. It's not just about tech. It's not just about the top five tech stocks. It really is about a rotation. And I think that a rotation into a broader, deeper market is actually a very positive thing for the future of the index. We want to see more participation. Now, that said, I also think that the stats with respect to how big tech was are a little bit overblown. And I say that because even at the peak of tech stocks at the end of August, still more than 60% of the S&P 500 was participating in this rally. So that's enough breadth to suggest that, you know, with more than 60% of stocks trading above their 200-day moving average, you're in a pretty solid condition. More than 70% of stocks were trading above their 50-day moving average at that point. Yes, tech was driving big, big gains, and when you have the biggest stocks driving performance, then the index is going to be naturally somewhat dependent upon those stocks. But to say there was no other participation is a vast overstatement of what's been going on. Most stocks are rising, and that's a generally pretty healthy condition. If that weren't the case, we would be much more cautious. If we weren't seeing rotation into other groups, if we were seeing excessive dependence on tech, no other stocks or no other groups in the index were participating in the rally, then we would have to be more concerned about the durability of the equity market advance.
You know, another interesting question is, what does this look like, let's say, when we get COVID behind us? You know, obviously, I think there's going to be some changes, whether it's services or how we spend money. Amazon will continue to grow. I think they're hiring, what, 100,000 new workers? People will shop more online. Maybe they go to the movies less and they use Netflix more. You take a look at what's happening to gyms. I mean, you take a look at Peloton. which has just gone through the roof as a result of COVID. They're selling more bikes and treadmills than they ever have in the past. So you kind of wonder, what are the companies or what are going to be the businesses that do well coming out of COVID?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that the crystal ball is still pretty hazy. What I tend to do is just follow earnings trends. And a lot of this will depend upon when we technically come out of COVID, which, you know, that definition is going to vary by the person that you talk to. Nonetheless, if you look at 2021 and where you're supposed to see earnings grow the fastest, the groups that are supposed to show the fastest earnings groups are the groups that are starting to perform better now. It's the industrials and materials and consumer discretionary companies outside of Amazon. It's some of the energy and financial companies. It's super cyclical groups that have been beaten down that nobody wants to own, that are starting to show some recovery prospects now because their earnings growth should be faster into next year. Now, is that earnings growth faster because we're seeing a mass demand acceleration? Maybe not. A lot of it is that these were really just beaten up. You know, many companies were producing no earnings growth or negative earnings growth over the course of the last couple of quarters. And so they've got easy comparisons. So any modest improvement in the outlook benefits them more than other groups. I think if you're looking into a longer term 2022, I think what consumers do with their money, with their savings, is going to be somewhat dependent upon how long this crisis lasts. You know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I kind of miss going places and being with people. I wouldn't mind going back to a gym if I were feeling more confident about exposing myself to other individuals. So I think a lot of this is going to depend upon how long are we sort of stuck. I don't know that a lot of people actually want to live the lifestyle that we live now. I think many people would like to get back to a general lifestyle where they're a little bit more interactive in society. So I wouldn't hang my hat too heavily on the things that are working now, continuing to work in a year or two, if we do see a vaccine developed and we can develop some confidence as a nation or as a consumer society in interacting again with other fellow humans live as opposed to on the line.
Yeah, I think it would just be nice to go out in public without a mask.
Yeah, keep that bar low, right?
Last night I was going to a takeout and to pick up some food, and I forgot to put my mask on. And I was just like, well, I couldn't get in. I had to go back to my car and get the mask. But yeah, it'd be nice. I want to talk about the stock market and yield. I mean, if we take a look at basically the Fed says they're going to keep rates low for a long period of time. You've got 10-year treasuries roughly around 0.7%, 1.4 in the 30-year bond. I mean, what do pension funds, insurance companies, and retirees do for income? I mean, imagine that you spent 40 years of your working career, you saved up, you've got this chunk of cash in your 401k or IRA rollover, and now you need income to live on. It seems like still, if you look at the stock market, the best yields are in the market.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think, you know, there's really two stories as to what's going on with yield in the equity market. There's earnings yield and there's dividend yield, and both of them have the capability to be a yield trap. So you want to be really careful in what yield you buy. Obviously, there's a decent amount of earnings yield as well as dividend yield available in some pretty considerable junk right now. And some of that junk is certainly subject to bankruptcy risk and a whole host of other concerns that the Fed is, as you mentioned at the onset of our interview here, highlighting. So you want to avoid, I would suggest, doing your homework significant when it comes to finding yield in the equity market is the right thing to do. And you want to avoid those junkier areas where you're not going to have a lot of confidence that the companies are going to survive or even maintain their position in large cap stocks. However, if you look at the market as a whole, even with the somewhat expensive or high valuation tech stocks included, the S&P 500 as a whole is offering you extremely high earnings yield relative to the yield that you can get anywhere else. Corporate bonds, treasury bonds, we're talking, we're in the 95th percentile of history in terms of the yield that the equity market is offering, well, it's relative to the bond market. So I think that the long answer to your short question is, what are investors going to do? They continue to get dragged into the equity market kicking and screaming. There's not a lot of love for equities out there, aside from a few beloved names. The broad equity markets are still extremely undervalued relative to the bond market. And this has been sort of a tenet of the bull market that's been in place since 2009. Nobody wants to own it, but it keeps moving higher, and it keeps moving higher because investors are getting pulled in kicking and screaming. And nonetheless, as long as these yields are so attractive relative to other asset classes, it's going to be really hard to resist and hard to avoid.
So given where you think you are, and we're seeing this rotation taking place as we talk materials, industrials, things that would do well with the economy expanding, what would you be doing with money right now?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what investor you're talking about, what their risk tolerance levels are, if it's an institution or an individual, how old that individual is. So it is very much a personal decision, and I think that you do want to stick to a longer-term investment plan, in particular if you're a retail investor. You want to think about your allocations pretty carefully. I think it's a really pretty easy call to suggest that over the longer term, with bond yields where they are right now, with the Fed committed to extremely easy policy, with the fact that we're just digging our way out of an extraordinarily painful recession, the value to me is still in taking on risk. There just seems to be too much excess allocation to safety. And so where you can take on some degree of risk, whether it be equities or even really high quality equities, that's still risk relative to the bond market. It seems to me that you're going to get paid for taking on that risk. And that's reflected in the equity risk premium that we were just talking about. So, I don't think that there's this sort of reticence on the part of the investment community to really adopt equity ownership after getting burned in the 2000 crisis and then again in 2009 and in 2020. What I'll say is very few people are regretting their decision to hold on to equities through the whole 20-year time period or the whole 30-year time period. You're still up. I think that market timing is really a difficult game. And if you're always looking for the right time to get in instead of sticking with it, a sort of programmed strategy for continuous allocation into some degree of risk, you're probably going to miss out. So I think there's a benefit to owning equities in any environment. But right now, it doesn't seem terribly risky to me to allocate some of the equity market.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, I know I read your stuff on Bloomberg Terminals. If our listeners have another way that they could find out the things that you write about, how could they do so?
Yeah. If they are not a Bloomberg Terminal subscriber, then they're going to have a hard time getting access to our work, just to be honest. You can reach out to me anytime on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm Gina Martin Adams in both locations. And you can get snippets of our work in both of those locations as well.
Well, Gina, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
All right. Thank you much. Take care.
We have this mistake, and mainstream economics perpetuates this mistake because it doesn't like the fact that money is part of the economy. The thing I find quite amusing when you hear people talking about economists who haven't actually done an economics degree, they think economists are experts on money because they're experts in the economy and the economy is all about money. So, hey, economists must know about money. In fact, the mainstream, they want to pretend that money is just a veil over barter. So forget about money, look through it and you'll see barter operations and you can ignore the monetary system. And that means for that reason, economists are the most confused people about money. Rather than being experts, they've deliberately not studied the monetary system.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news? Selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one asset class that's been helping the gold and precious metals market this year has been the dollar. After peaking in early March, it's been on a downtrend. Recently, it's been going sideways. Where do we go from here? Joining us from Bannockburn Global Forex is Mark Chandler. Mark, looking at the dollar, you wrote a piece, "Is the bounce nearly over?" So let's talk about where you think this dollar is heading.
Yeah, so I kind of think that dollar had two legs, growth differentials and interest rate differentials. And both of those legs have weakened. And we did see, so a sequence of events through the first half, when everything's said and done, the dollar is pretty flat. And so the dollar setback really took place in July. And like you said, we've been going sideways since. But I think that the big dollar cycle is over. And so I'd be looking at the dollar to finish this year a couple percentage points weaker than it's currently trading.
So one of the things that has always helped the dollar in the past has been the interest rates. And of course, now we're back down to zero. But Mark, when we look overseas, I mean, they're negative in Europe. They're next to nothing in Japan. So what is driving this down? Is it the deficits, the Fed's policy? What, in your opinion, is creating the end of this cycle?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that a couple of things have changed. So like I mentioned, the growth differentials have really narrowed. And to your point about the negative yields, and there's about $15 trillion of negative yielding bonds in Europe and Japan. But I think that what happens is that because of the U.S. current account deficit and large budget deficit, it typically needs to offer a bigger premium that has higher interest rates relative to other countries. And while it still offers a premium, it is about half of what it was, say, a year and a half ago. And so I think that a combination of these fundamental factors, like the fundamental legs of the dollar weakening, at the same time that the dollar was overvalued by most measures, and I think President Trump had that story right, and the fact that because the dollar had rallied for so long, almost a decade, a lot of fund managers were overweight. So you combine these things, a deteriorating fundamental picture with an overvalued dollar and one in which people are overpositioned, over long. And so I think that's the makings of the bear market. And then the trend, of course, once it's in place, it has a habit of staying in place. And that's what I like about the foreign exchange market. You don't have to be right often because the trends can last 5 or 10 years.
You know, there was an article in the Financial Times recently, and they're talking about the traditional diversification policies of, you know, having a bond portfolio to maybe diversify from stocks. So if the stock market goes down, the bond market goes up. They're saying that isn't working like it used to because yields are negative or at zero. But one thing that has replaced it for a lot of bond managers has been the currency market. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point. This is really more about the micro market, the micro structure, if you will, of how the markets are organized. And how can one achieve diversification? And diversification, if there's a holy grail in investment, it's diversification. And how can it be achieved when the capital markets, that is the global bond market, seems to be moving in sync, highly correlated, very low yields. Broadly speaking, it could be said about the stock market too, that for the most part, what this is saying is that in the last 20 or 30 years, capital markets have evolved and converged. And so how can one get diversification? Well, currencies still seem to offer that, but I think that people are looking at beyond currencies as well. I think that's the interest, or part of the interest in the cyber currency space. It's the interest in commodities as an investable part of a portfolio. It's the reason that people are attracted or drawn to the emerging markets, another way to diversify. And I And I think that that's really the driving force. And you see what we've done in the ETF space. There's practically an ETF for almost every market segment you can imagine. And so I think that this is an ongoing quest. And it's nothing, I don't see it as being very new. If anything, what's new about it is just how comprehensive it is and how low interest rates are and how low they're going to be for a prolonged period of time.
So when we take a look at interest rates at zero, and it looks like, you know, the Fed's comment, they're not even thinking of lowering rates. I've heard 2025 before they even look at it. Let's talk about the stock market, because I take a look at treasuries, 0.6%, 0.7%, 30-year bonds at 1.3 to 1.5, depending on what point you're looking at, you can get better yields in the stock market. I mean, I can look at some of the blue chips in the Dow and get yields that are 1%, 1.5% more than what I could get in treasury bonds. So how does that change the investment mix when you can get better, you know, you think of pension funds, you think of retirees that need to live on income. Are we in a TINA market?
Yeah, I think two things that I think like are driving it, but they stem from low interest rates. On one hand, to your point, the low interest rates available in the fixed income market encourages or drives savers into the equity market. At the same time, from a fundamental point of view, when you try to discount future earnings, interest rates play a big role. So the low interest rates allow for, say, larger multiples, price to earnings. And so I think both of those drivers are lifting the stock market broadly. But remember what's going on, too. We have a very narrow stock market rally. I was reading that if you take away 5 of the S&P 500, take 1% of them away, that most of the other 495 stocks are down for the year.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing. People are looking at the S&P thinking it's a good year, when actually, if you back out the big five, the big fang stocks, the S&P is actually down.
Yeah, so I think that this makes it difficult, I think, for investors. I know it makes it difficult for myself, because on one hand, you say, those fangs, everybody's in them. And we saw what happened. I mean, the first week in September or so, it sold off by 10% or so. You know, and so so for me, I think that my mutual fund investments in my 401k are probably picking up on the fangs. So how can I add value to those to that situation? How can I add value to my portfolio? I think it really requires doing more homework. So complementing this passive investing in the index type instruments and looking for some undiscovered nuggets or other ways to play the theme. So for example, one of the things that I like is manufacturing, because I think the dollar is going to weaken. And I think that regardless of what happens in November, economic nationalism is on the rise. And so that tells me that we're going to get more import substitution strategies. What we used to import, we want to build ourselves. So I am looking at manufacturers. And the, you know, I think big at first, of course, so that'd be like 3M. But I also think that what the COVID crisis has shown us is that the medical profession, pharmaceuticals, are also like a emerging market. That there's always, that as we get older, as society advances, we are going to get, whether it's other COVIDs or science being applied to us living longer, conquering diseases and whatnot. And so I look at some of the biotech companies, and I've been following CRISPR as an example of something in that space. So I think that in this kind of environment, when you've got the narrow breadth of the stock market, and you have some passive investment, you assume that those index funds are really tracking those fangs. So how can you add value? And I think think about what the future is going to be, find some themes, and look for the best of the breed in those themes.
Let's talk about another way that you can diversify your portfolio, maybe, and this relates to the dollar. Let's talk about commodities, and especially gold, and then maybe look at the cryptocurrencies. What's your view there?
So gold, I like gold, though I think that here's the challenge is we're coming up from such low levels. I turned bullish around 1400, and I'm not always bullish on gold, but I saw it as an important development, and I see a good macro narrative around it, low interest rates, geopolitical uncertainty, these kinds of things, I think, continue to underpin it. And but where are we? We went up to the 2000, shot through that 2075 or so, but for the most part, we're really trading 1900 to 2000. And today we're smack in the middle of that range. So it's hard to get excited about it here, but I'd be watching those extremes, 1900 on the downside, 2000 on the upside. I'm bullish. I think that given my dollar view, my interest rate view, I can see gold going up another 10% next year, 10, 15%. So call it 2200, 2300.
So as you look at that, and of course, we're moving into this new green world where you're seeing, you know, the Teslas. It's remarkable when you look at, you know, we talk about some of these FANG stocks, and you look at the valuation of Tesla, which is worth more than the entire auto industry, and they only make 375,000 cars. So, you know, I keep thinking of, Mark, this new world we're moving in coming out of COVID. We've got anarchy in a lot of the major cities right now. That's got to be bullish for gold, but also what I call the new kind of post-COVID world where, you know, we find out we can work from home. So there's less office space. Maybe people are shopping more online. So you need less, let's say, commercial shopping centers. And then all this technology with Zoom impacting, let's say, travel and the hotel industry. So what about new types of businesses that are coming out, whether it's, green cars, EV cars, and things like that?
And I think you're right. I think that's what I think how we can add value is thinking about some of those industries or sectors that are going to be in this post-COVID. What have people done a lot of during this COVID in the U.S.? They buy a pet. And so what's going to happen when they go back to work or when life resumes or when the pet loses its sort of newness? So I suspect a couple of things happen. And one of them is there's going to be a lot more pet care. I'm not talking about pet.com, but I'm talking about companies that'll be built to help service people of ownership of pets, especially middle and upper middle class people who will try to outsource the messy part of it, at least. And so I think you're right, though. Thinking about what does this mean? I know that when people got excited about a possible vaccine, the return to work was going to reduce that the Zoom had its day or Amazon had its day. As soon as things open up, some of the froth will be removed. I don't know. I think that some of these changes are going to be permanent. Like you say, people now have the ability to work from home. Though I did read a study that said people's productivity working at home falls on Monday and on Friday, but it tends to be stronger during the week than it is at the office. So we'll have to work these kind of things out and other studies for confirmation. But I do think that in many ways, the COVID is going to accelerate some trends that were already in place.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at some of these companies like Peloton, which they weren't making much money, and then all of a sudden COVID hits, and their sales go off the charts. And, you take a look at the market value, people are saying, you know what, maybe I don't need to go to the gym. I can buy a piece of equipment, work out at home, and, you know, I don't have to worry about, you know, putting my gym clothes on, drive to the gym, wait in line, and I just do it when I want to.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of this. I could have called this idea that you touch on, I think, is very important. I think that's also one of these new memes, if you will. And I sort of called it custom-made mass production. So, for example, you can go to Nike's website, and you can pick a bunch of soles, a bunch of uppers, some different colored laces, and you can make your own pair of shoes almost as cheap as it is to buy one off the rack. And so I think that a lot of this is individuation, but being able to maximize it or do the economic efficiency of mass production. In some ways, it's like 3D printing, and it follows like just-in-time inventories. And so I think these are things that technology makes available and that we then try to incorporate them more into whether it's cost savings, labor savings, or capital savings.
So given the fact that you think the dollar's long-term cycle is over, how would you be placing funds as an investor today?
That's what I was thinking before, is who in the U.S., what kind of U.S. companies benefit from a weaker dollar? And that would be exporters. It would be, in my view, it would be also manufacturers who have to reshore, onshore, or nearshore production that had previously been overseas. I think looking at overseas, also looking at foreign markets, are also, for a while, the dollar sort of acted as a headwind against that. But if I'm right, the dollar acts as a tailwind, and that is by diversifying, by having euro-denominated assets, equities, for example, or sterling, or Australian dollar, or Canadian dollar, by diversifying out of the U.S. So those are the global equity indexes, benchmarks. And there's some in the ETF space, and there's some in the open-end mutual funds. So there's different ways to do that, but I think international investment, this would be the time to begin thinking about that, whether it's dollar cost averaging or finding an ETF you like. I think that it's a international investment and finding the companies here at home that benefit from a weaker dollar.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, if people like to follow, why don't you tell our listeners, you have a blog, you write letters, how they can follow you?
I have a blog called Mark to Market, and that's Mark with a C. I thought it was kind of a clever marketing device at the time. It really comes from a book, my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. And that was published by Bloomberg. I'm also on Twitter, and there my handle also tied in with the book is at Mark Making Sense. I have another book that's out that's called Political Economy of Tomorrow. And in that book, I think I even though it came out a couple of years ago, I think it's still a fair assessment of where we're headed.
And you can find that at Amazon.
Yes.
Mark, as always, thanks for coming on the program. We always appreciate it. Stay safe and come back again.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Welcome to this week's edition of Smart Macro. Joining us, as always, is the Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Paplava. So, Chris, starting last month, particularly in August, you and I had been discussing how far extended the tech sector had gotten above its 50-day moving average and how that this was really pointing to the likelihood of a pullback in the weeks ahead. And, of course, we can see in hindsight, September 2nd at the start of this month was really the peak in the NASDAQ and in the broader tech sector. And 2 weeks ago, you had mentioned that you thought that this pullback, although healthy, was likely to continue. Give us an update on where things stand in terms of whether or not this pullback in the tech sector is still healthy in your mind, whether or not you think it still has more to go, and just your general thoughts on the broader market.
Big picture, and I think it's always important to start from a high level and then work your way down. There's no debate, no question that the tech sector is in a bull market. You've got all the long-term moving averages, momentum, everything is saying new highs, that tech is clearly in a bull market, as is the overall stock market. However, you know, even if the tech sector pulls down to its 50-day, which we were discussing over a month ago would happen, we initially saw the sector bounce off of that. And since the we last spoke 2 weeks ago, the sector's essentially been trading sideways. And I felt that we still had more to go. And clearly, with the breakdown today in the NASDAQ, the S&P, the S&P tech sector, through the 50-day, that we are not done. But, you know, even if we went all the way down to the 200-day moving average on the S&P, I mean, we're talking almost a loss of 500 points. That would still be in a bullish trend. You know, long-term moving averages or moving averages in general kind of act like gravity, you know, like a stretched rubber band, they eventually snap back to it. So, you know, if you look at the S&P, for example, if it fell a couple more hundred points, that really just kind of takes it back to its former highs of this year in February. Still very, very healthy, very normal to have corrections. You know, I think when the market really starts to take off, people forget stocks are volatile. You know, they kind of get used to stocks only going up. And, you know, it's very common in any given year to see multiple 5% corrections, even a 10% correction, I believe, you know, roughly around once a year. So, you know, we did have obviously a bear market earlier this year, but still, when you see the performance and the moves that we've seen in the tech sector and some of the retail names, you know, clearly they were kind of moving in the stratosphere and needed to calm down. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, one of the things I mentioned is what's very important is to see what happens when a key leading sector or industry begins to come under pressure. What you don't want to see is for money to move out of that sector and go into cash or bonds. That's more of a underlining shift in tone. But instead, what's healthy is if you see a rotation into other areas. And that's exactly what we are seeing. And that's what keeps a bull market alive and healthy. For example, you know, since the market peaked on September 2nd through today, as of today, the S&P Internet retail industry is down 16%. Tech hardware is down 15%. Semiconductor equipment is 15%. Internet media, 14%. Application software is down 13%. So you can see on and on that the tech industries are dominating the worst performing industry groups. Now, on the flip side, with tech down double digits, there's other industries that are actually doing quite well. Food distributors or S&P food distributors are up 11%. S&P department store index is up 11%. Housewares is up 9%. You've got apparel and accessories up 6%. Diverse chemicals are up 6%, commodity chemicals are up 5%, construction materials up 5%. So clearly, and I can go on and on, there's multiple industries that have had a great run in the last 2 weeks. So that to me is healthy, and that's why I think that this pullback in tech is healthy and constructive, but I'm still bullish overall on the big picture.
It's interesting because we spoke with Gina Martin Adams from Bloomberg on her show earlier today as our technician, and I know that you follow her work, but she's also saying that we're seeing this rotation underway and that this is a positive sign for the market, right? The worst thing you want to see is a complete risk-off move where everyone is just exiting the stock market, regardless of what sector you're talking about, even value, just to raise money. So during this tech-led downturn, which was overly concentrated, again, way extended above its 50-day moving average and a lot of the things that we've been discussing over the past month or so, so far, we're seeing this rotation, and that's keeping the bull market alive as far as you see. Let's broaden out a little bit further. What else are you looking at in terms of what could sustain this bull market and not lead to major downturn or even some people say that, you know, we could see a double-dip recession?
One of the things I do every week is I do a lot of research looking at economic data, looking at the internals of the stock market. I also have the ability to survey a lot of research that we get, some of it free and some of it paid research, either to challenge my viewpoints or sharpen them, or also provide other insights or point me in directions that I'm not currently looking at. And there's a lot of great research, and I really do like the research that comes out of Morgan Stanley. And they had a great report where they really delved into the change of Jerome Powell's with the Fed at his Jackson Hole speech, in which he said the Fed was moving towards an average inflation target regime, meaning they're going to allow inflation to run hot, which essentially means above 2%, and not immediately raise interest rates as they have in the past. And what essentially Morgan Stanley believes is if the Fed adopted this policy, that the first rate hike in the last cycle under Ben Bernanke was December of 2015. But under this new framework, they believe the Fed would not have hiked rates until 3 years later in 2018 would be the first rate hike. So we're talking 10 years of zero interest rate policy by the Federal Reserve, according to Morgan Stanley, if they adopted this under the last cycle. Now, going forward, as the Fed has stated, this is going to be their new framework. What they believe is that this is going to lead to higher structural inflation than what is normal. They also believe that the first rate hike will likely not happen until at least the first half of 2024. But just like in the last cycle, before the Fed raises rates for the first time, they're first going to stop expanding their balance sheet with tapering and then ultimately ending their balance sheet expansion. They believe tapering will begin not for another 2 years. So by the middle of 2022 is when Morgan Stanley believes the Fed will start to slow down their purchases, with ending it completely by early 23, and then the first rate hike not until a year later in 2024. So essentially, we've got years of easy monetary policy ahead of us. And if we simply just look at what happens when the Fed is expanding its balance sheet, clearly that it's favorable for equities, commodities, and we've also seen a general rise in interest rates, which means this could hurt bonds if we see the same tendencies as we have in the past.
Okay, so currently there is a rotation underway from overextended pricey areas of the market, most notably technology, into more cyclical, economically sensitive areas. That's something that we have been discussing on our show with you in prior Smart Macro segments, and that's also what Gina Martin Adams had said on today's show. Fed monetary policy is still a tailwind for equities. They've doubled down on that and said that they're going to be keeping rates low for many years to come. So that is also constructive for risk assets, like you said, commodities and other areas. Anything else that you'd like to share with our audience in terms of what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management or your general outlook?
Another thing that Morgan Stanley pointed out, which I fully agree with, is, you know, looking at the near term, you know, they are bullish longer term, but near term wise, there is some risk if we don't see Congress pass a second round of stimulus. However, there's plenty of scope in terms of the Fed's balance sheet to step in should the need arise if we can't get some traction. The Fed has already authorized up to $7 trillion expansion in its balance sheet. And so far, it's only expanded its balance sheet by $2.3 trillion. So we're talking $5.7 trillion of more potential stimulus coming from the Fed to help support financial markets if there's any volatility, either due to COVID, the elections, a lack of stimulus in terms of a possible double dip recession. But, you know, as we saw in March, and we've seen time and time again, whenever there's trouble, the authorities come to, you know, support and stabilize the markets and economy and prop things back up. So in my view, you know, the time to really move towards a defensive stance is typically near the end of an investment cycle where unemployment rate is at its lowest, when the Fed is tightening, not easing. And that described the environment that we saw in 2018 when unemployment was falling below the lowest level in half a century. The Fed had already undergone multiple rate hikes. We were starting to see some unraveling in the credit markets because of that tightening bias. We are nowhere close to that. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we're talking years and years away before the Fed even thinks about raising interest rates. So again, in my view, absolutely near term, there's plenty of catalysts that could cause the market to sell off, as we just mentioned. But I do believe that would be a buying opportunity, not a reason to sell in panic.
And we're actually going to be airing an interview with Lauren Seidel Baker at ITR Economics. And she had said that 11 of their 12 leading economic indicators that they follow are now rising, and that that's positive for the economic recovery. They do see some slight slowing of momentum. However, they think that the official recession, which started in February, will eventually be declared to have ended in the second half of this year, and that the recovery will take a broader hold, not just in the consumer space, but also in the more manufacturing industrial sector in 2021 next year. So they're fairly optimistic on the environment.
You know, I confirm that view. For example, you know, I'm looking at manufacturing, specifically the US ISM Manufacturing Index. One of the leading relationships that gives you kind of a lead time of the ISM is looking at the new orders to inventories ratio. And that continues to climb, which is a leading component of the ISM and points to further improvement in manufacturing. I also agree that we're probably coming out of the recession, or it's going to be, you know, any month now. One of the reasons I say that is when you look at the average aggregate weekly hours, whether you're looking at the retail sector or manufacturing sector, we've already seen a dramatic rebound. The work week shrank on par with what we saw in 2009. And as soon as the average work week hours began to pick up, that defined the end of the recession. And we've already seen a massive jump in terms of the annual work week hours being spent. So that does kind of, you know, point towards the recession being over. I am encouraged that even with the stimulus beginning to roll off, as well as the number of COVID numbers picking up, if you look at mobility in some key states, they're staying constant. We're not gaining any more ground, but we're also not losing it. So that, to me, is at least positive in the sense that mobility trends are not rolling over. And again, further, as I mentioned, there's plenty of stimulus from legislative actions that could still come. The Federal Reserve, And it's, you know, it's not just here in the U.S. where we're seeing some positive developments. In Germany, the German Zoo Expectations for Economic Growth survey, that does a pretty good job of leading Germany GDP. We've had a massive recovery in that index, which points to a recovery in Germany. And then also one of the things I've, you know, mentioned in the past is copper. You know, they say copper has a PhD in economics and they call it Dr. Copper, because copper is a vital component in economic growth in terms of recoveries. It's used in so many different facets of an economy that watching copper prices and demand for copper gives you a pretty good idea of where the economy is going. And one of the things I want to highlight is that if you look at the imports of copper by China, they exploded over the last few months, more than we had ever seen before, which essentially is way above what we saw coming out of the 08-09 crisis. It is the highest level of imports of copper ever, and it is dramatically high. And, you know, even the month-to-month, although last month did come in a little bit, it is still higher than any other of the monthly import observations we had ever seen in China. So clearly, the global economy is on a recovery path. There's going to be some bumps out there. But again, you know, my view is that we're very early in the recovery process, not at the end. And I think there's a lot more room for improvement ahead.
So in sum, the rotation underway from richly priced tech stocks into cyclical value areas of the market is healthy and indicative of an ongoing bull market. U.S. central bank policy is still quite loose in providing a tailwind for risk assets, and leading economic indicators are pointing towards a further recovery. In that case, given what we've discussed, we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are using this and further corrections as buying opportunities in attractive areas of the market. With that said, Chris, what are some of the various services provided at Financial Sense Wealth Management, either for individuals, businesses, or institutions, and how can our listeners get in touch with us?
We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance, particularly with interest rates at 0%. They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks. Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour and our Smart Macro segment with Chris Poplava. Again, if you'd like to give him a call to discuss his investment outlook or to speak with any of our financial advisors, you can do so by giving us a call at 888-486-3939. We do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.